Brigadier Calvertry 3.
Yes, I was just saying that after about 18 months in Trieste, which is a very interesting part of the world, as it was where East met West, and incidentally, it is a great place for espionage. I was posted at my request off to China. I guess get back onto that bit of espionage. At that time, in 1948, everybody was winding up various intelligence organizations. SOE was wound up very quickly. But there were many other organizations. In Trieste, there were American organizations, Italian organizations, of course, Yugoslav and Russian and British. And another job I was given was to coordinate Allied intelligence. And I had the tricky job of trying to get people to agree. I was ably supported by an American who was of Red Indian vintage, and he didn't say very much, but he gave me sound and earthy advice at times. The sort of problems were that an admiral might escape from Hungary. The British Navy would say that he'd been taught at Dartmouth, and the British Navy wanted to have him to interrogate him, and would conceal him and take him off. Now, we had a pact with America that we would, Britain and America had a pact that we would share any intelligence which came from the other side of the Iron Curtain. I'm not certain whether the Iron Curtain had actually come into existence then. And then the Americans, of course, had a large number of Yugoslavs who were in America, and they had relations in Yugoslavia and in also right the way throughout the Balkans. And they would use their methods to extract important people from behind the Iron Curtain and to smuggle them over to America without giving us a chance to interrogate them. And there was a lot of rows and internal complaints about both the British and the Americans trying to conceal their agents from each other. And we were both, this American Indian and myself, were given things in confidence. But we decided to be completely open to each other, whether it was right or not, I don't know. Remember, we were under quite a different government, an Allied government. I had seen General Airy on this beforehand. And so we would try and sort these matters out. But there were people being killed. One amusing, when it might, perhaps it wasn't all that amusing, black humor, was a British soldier a deserter tried to cross the frontier into Yugoslavia. It's on a wooded, hilly ground. And he was shot on the boundary by the Yugoslavs. We, of course, made protests and so on, and it all went very high up, and there were messages flashing backwards and forwards. And I was put in charge of the chap on the ground to consider all this. Now, first of all, the frontier, as it then was the Morgan Line. General Morgan, at the end of the war, had gone over to the Yugoslavs and had drawn a line in thick black pencil on an atlas saying which where the boundary would be. But when you put this on the ground, the thick black line was about 200 yards wide. And so both the Yugoslavs and the Italians and ourselves' idea where the boundary was of course vague. And whether a man had crossed the frontier or not depended on where you put this line. That is one reason why we had this boundary commission. But the result was this man was left lying in this indeterminate area, whilst London, Washington, and Moscow, and Belgrade argued. And I eventually went up, and I had photographs taken of it, and there was the corpse was by now being eaten by maggots. And I had the close-up of this done, and I showed it. I sent my report in and showed the picture of this chap being eaten by maggots. And this hurried things along very quickly, because when they saw that during their time they were deliberating, they could be criticized for the way they treated his corpse. And so it was decided, so the Yugoslavs took the body away and gave a magnificent funeral with a couple of bands and this, that and the other to this poor British worker and soldier who had been sacrificed by the monarcho-fascist governments. And when he tried to save himself by coming to over to the communist governments, he was shot. And this was put all over the place. And he was buried, and they even got hold of a sort of bishop or something to bury him. And so later on, in negotiations, we insisted on getting his body back, and in exchange for something else, his body was disinterred. Now, I had to arrange all this, and I didn't know at the time there is a ceremony and a service for disinterment, and this had to be done, and so we brought over a party with a bishop and so on like that, so that he was disinterred from his grave, and brought across the frontier with an escort, Yugoslav escort to the frontier, and then a British-American escort to Trieste, and there another funeral party was given, and he was again buried in the British cemetery there, and shots fired over him, and bands, and so on. And what I say is black humour, because this man had a most appalling record in the British Army. He was the Royal Army Service Corps, he'd been court-martialed, he was an absolute thief, and so on. And there he was, having two major burials in his life, and that's where his triumph, notoriety, occurred. I mentioned that as a type of thing going on. That and the intelligence side was very difficult. And I mentioned, I think, once before, once you get mixed up in intelligence, these intelligence organizations fight each other like mad, and it's best to keep out of it, and you never know when you're not going to be blamed yourself for it. But fortunately, I always had the very great support of General Airey, who was an expert in this sort of thing. Well, now I better get on to Hong Kong. Well, I was made G1 Air in Hong Kong, and there was a division plus in Hong Kong, and whilst I was there, the Korean War started. I could have gone to the Korean War, but I was involved in teaching close air support. We had two Spitfire squadrons and two naval air squadrons. I forget the name, Fireflies, I think, was one, and I can't remember the others. And I organized at Castle Peak a bombing ground, and where we had a competition for bombing off the map on gridded air mosaics, on ground-to-air conversations, directing people onto targets, and I brought up the whole of the division, and the judges were the Governor-General, or Governor, he was not Governor-General, Governor, the Admiral, the Air Force Air Vice Marshal, and the GOC, and we had it all wired up so they could all listen to the conversation between the pilots and the ground, and it gave a very visual description. Well, everybody had to climb up about 1,500 feet or more to where to see into this great bowl, which was our target range. And all the troops were there, and they could listen into the conversation. And we had a competition between these four squadrons, and remember the Royal Navy saying, oh, we're bound to win it, you see, we're all officers. And the actual fact is that RAF Spitfire Squadron used to win it the 2 years I was there, and I called it the Bang On Prize, BHANG hyphen OHN, and it was of a naked Chinese girl like this, and
with her arms out.
It was presented with her arms out, and it was presented to the different squadrons. But it did give all ranks a tremendous idea of what the Air Force could do and how they could support them and what their limitations were. It also, by listening to the pilot's remarks, they could see his difficulties. I always remember one story. There was the reconnaissance Spitfire squadron who weren't all that good at bombing, and one of their aircraft wasn't maintaining formation, and the squadron leader said, I forget the names of what they call each other, up G7, you see, and G7 said, acknowledged it, and then he said, up G7, you're out of position. And he kept saying, up G7, you see. And then G7 finally answered. This was broadcast to a few thousand troops and all these distinguished gathering. I'm flying as fast as I fucking well can. And there was a great roar of laughter and tremendous sympathy for the pilots, of course. And it did, and I was very glad to hear that when this division went up to the brigade from the division went up to Korea and forming the Commonwealth Division, that the Air Force squadrons and the Royal Navy squadrons went up with them. They gave them magnificent air support. Well, then, I was suggested by Slim, who was Chief Imperial General Staff, to General Harding, that I should be sent to Malaya to make a report on what was going on there. Things were not going well. And in great secrecy, I was seen. I went down to Singapore and was seen by General Harding, whom I have a very high opinion of, although he had to give me a rocket once or twice. I was sent to do a reconnaissance as long as I liked and find out what was wrong. And I would give initial reports as I went along to Harding.
How did Harding put the problem to you when you saw him?
I think he said things aren't going nearly as well as we had hoped. General Slim says you know all about guerrilla warfare, and I give you carte blanche, you can go where you like and see whom you like to discover what is wrong. He said the police aren't working very well with the army, the civil government aren't doing this. Of course, a lot of the civil government had been prisoners of war, there's the problems of the sultans and, of course, the Chinese versus the Malays, and then the various mercantile interests, the rubber plantations, the tin mines, and we've tried to form a special force, Sparrow Force, but this was run by Sir Robert Thompson, or Robert Thompson, who was your Air Force officer, later became Sir Robert Thompson, and two or three officers who stayed behind in Malaya. But they haven't got on well with the army. And I want you to look at all this and report to me. Now, General Urquhart was GOC Malaya. General Harding was GOC and C Far East. There was, of course, governors of Malaya and governors of Singapore. There was also Malcolm MacDonald, who was the Prime Minister's representative out there. Had a funny job. I never knew which side he was on.
How do you mean?
Well, he was giving reports to the Labour government at home, and they were at the reports were at variance with what, say, General Harding said, or what the governor of Malaya said, and so on. He was supposed to give a sort of overall viewpoint, and of course he had his own staff and his own advisers, and there was a certain amount of friction between them and people in Malaya and people in Singapore. The British Army had gone back to the most stultified setup in Singapore and to a certain extent in Malaya. What I think I mentioned this before, what had happened was prisoners of war, some of whom had been prisoners of war for 5 years, had received promotion whilst they were in prisoner of war camps, and they'd come back into the army and were made senior staff officers and commanders of battalions, and they had, most of them had little idea of all the advances made between 1939 and 1945. And their only thing they knew was to bring back things into peacetime regulations. And so they were great sticklers of sort of peacetime regulations. And I think I have mentioned the fact when I took a patrol out and we got everybody, got the guerrillas really running and they were going into our ambushes, that the company commander whom I was with, who was a very good chap in the KOR lie, he said, "Now, I've got to go. we had ambushed two or three parties, and we were doing some more. And I said, why? And he said, the colonel has said that he's having a guest night on Thursday, and his orders are that every officer will attend a guest night. And so I've got to pack up. And so he marched off. He'd like to have stayed, and he felt he was doing a good job. They'd been in for about 3 weeks. And when I sent this report to General Harding, he was furious. And there was another people, backed up by medical officers, who'd never been in the Far East, as far as I know, who said that no man could last more than a week in the jungle. Well, having been in Burma when we were in the jungle for months and months and months on end, and later when I formed the SAS, we used to stay in the jungle for 3 months at a time. It was absurd. It was these sort of things which were preventing, or better allowing, a small group of Chinese guerrillas who were very well trained, had a lot of experience, from taking on the whole of the British Empire. And I think, I forget how many troops we had eventually, but including the Malays, local troops, it was something like 200,000 troops. And the Chinese guerrillas, they're mostly Chinese, were never more than about 7,000. Now, I have said this in my lectures, that there's an optimum, the amount of guerrillas you need in any bit of country. This optimum depends on, naturally, concealment, on raising recruitment, and on targets, and on food and supplies. And if you produce any more, it doesn't produce any more efficiency. If you reckon that the job of a guerrilla, his main object is to attack the economy of a nation and to wear it down and going on attacking it until the government concedes to him and realizes a tremendous financial drain and gives way to some of their demands, possibly all their demands. So what he's doing, he's attacking, or he should be attacking, the economy, which of course mainly is roads, and the communications, roads and railways and communications and factories and so on. And also he's got a psychological warfare which supports all this. Well, the guerrilla there, he had decided something between 5,000 and 7,000. He had his recruiting areas deep in the jungle where he trained, and his own headquarters was. I believed, after doing this reconnaissance, which I'll come back to later, it lasted almost 6 months, that we should go for these deep areas, and we should live inside the jungle, just like the guerrillas do. My simile was like the malarial germ, which was inserted into the bloodstream by the mosquito, and it circulated in the blood, and you had to put in an antibody like quinine, which also circulated in the same way as the malarial germ. And so if it met it, it could destroy it if it was strong enough. I've always given that simile. And so our job was to live in the jungle, as I said later, and which we did do. Now, a lot of people didn't agree with this. But to get back, I branched off from this. I was given the job of doing a reconnaissance, and I went out in Malaya with the British troops, Gurkha troops, Malayan troops. I went by air, bombing raids. I went by sea up the rivers. I went to Thailand and saw things from their side. I went with the police and special branch and in raids and things like that. And all the time I was writing reports back to General Harding. And my very questions and things like that did brace people up. I had to attend high-level conferences. And then I was told to go ahead. I was to form a small force of British troops to operate in the deep jungle. And if you will remember in my previous test, I'd said, tapes, I'd said that when the Special Air Service was disbanded, I had recommended that, or it had been made into, all but disbanded, been made into a territorial SAS, founded on the North London. I had said that I thought there should be a special counterinsurgency force, and it should have a name of its locality, but that its overall regiment should still be the Special Air Service, because SAS had had the best organization of all these special forces around the world. So when the recommendation went to the War Office, they recommended that this unit should be called... I was asked for a name, and I suggested the... South Pacific Rangers, because I anticipated there would be trouble elsewhere in the Pacific area, and it wouldn't be just Malaya itself. But there are Indian Army officers who thought of the Northwest Frontier, and they decided to call it the Malayan Scouts Special Air Service, 22nd Malayan Scouts Special Air Service. And this was the origin of the present 22nd SAS. But I also wrote, my own report, which was about 46 pages, and it went through General Harding and his chief of staff, General Poet, and up to the to Slim and to the War Cabinet. I was brought back and cross-questioned for about a fortnight on various aspects of it.
Brought back to where?
To Britain.